This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Treasures in the Dark, 90 Reflections on Finding Bright Hope Hidden in the Hurting, written and narrated by Catherine Wolfe, and is available everywhere audiobooks are sold.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pastor Mike, Dynamic Voices for a Diverse Church, powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at BurnsClan. Please follow at your own risk. And joining me, as always, is the founder of The Witness, very extensive bio, the man, the myth, the legend. What are you doing? I don't know. This is not a concert. I don't understand.
You sit there for like 10 seconds when somebody's introducing you, Ty. I mean, come on.
Now, why you calling me Ty? No, you don't get to do that. No, you don't get to do that. This is what I need Jamar to do. Y'all know how whenever there's guest pastors in a Black church, it's a very Black church, guest pastors in a Black church, and they're getting introduced by the head pastor, and the head pastor is, today we have a phenomenal gift from the Lord, the man of God. I first met this transformative young man. And then the guest preacher is just sitting there like...
That's precisely the right. Pose. That's the pose.
And you just sitting there like,
you just got to take it.
Right. You just got to accept it. Right. Like, you got to accept it. And there's one that I've started adopting where you just put your head in your hands. So you're just like,
Yep. That's me. I know. Yeah. Sounds pretty awesome. Right.
Dr. Jamar Tisby, jamartisby.substack.com. What's going on, brother?
Not much. Except the world seems to be on fire.
Okay, so yes. We always talk about this from a physical standpoint. There's multiple panoramics, multiple Pan's Labyrinths happening at the same time, it seems as though. But then also politically, it's like we can't get rid of 45. Like we can't get 45 out of...
He won't go away.
We can't get him out of the news cycle. We can't get him out of the conversations.
We got him Twitter. And
okay, we got him off Twitter. But now he's doing rallies.
They just screen cap what he does on True Social and put it on Twitter.
Why do they do that?
It's not fun.
So can we talk about why we share people we don't like on Twitter? Why do we do that?
Part of it, we want to dunk on them. Look how stupid this is.
True.
Part of it, though, is pedagogical, right? Like,
what?
See, there he goes again.
We're not going to do that.
We're not going to have the tyranny of low expectations.
Hold up now. Hold up now. Mr. SAT, now break down what you mean when you say pedagogical.
Pedagogical. Pedagogos, you know.
See, this is what I'm saying.
Teaching.
This is what I'm saying.
Instructional is what I mean. So part of the time, if we point to something we disagree with or something that we think is not helpful, part of it is to point out what's problematic about it so that other people can understand when they see it again.
Wow. That's helpful.
That's pedagogical, even.
Pedagogical. That's actually helpful. That's actually helpful. So people are sharing this. And then also beyond all of the sharing and the rallies, the FBI just did. I skipped over the committee, the January 6th committee, too.
Oh, yes, yes. Okay, yes. So, I mean, are they ever going to arrest this guy?
I feel like we should call the episode this. Like, are they ever going to arrest this man?
Or they not gonna?
Is this a universal Black feeling?
They not
too?
Finna.
It's right. What we not finna do is arrest him. Is this a universal Black feeling? This man's not getting arrested?
Okay, so I think so. Because of our relationship to law enforcement in general.
I kind of feel like they're going to do it. I don't feel like it's going to stick.
Yeah.
But I feel like they're going to do it.
It could. Although, I mean, the fear. Okay, so backing on up. All right. January 6th committee. Actually, in my opinion, this is a different topic, but they've done, I think, a very good job of publicizing the hearings.
Sure.
Having a few of them on prime time, having all of them televised, very intentionally getting Republicans and conservatives testifying in this. So there's less of a accusation of partisanship, even though it's still out there. So that, in addition to the FBI going inside Mar-a-Lago for classified documents that Trump took with him, which you're not supposed to do. Like, to me, that's open and shut. Is the stuff there?
Right.
he crossed the line.
But how did – so help me understand this. From what you understand, how did he get to take these documents?
He just took them.
They so was he just took the up. Documents and it was just like, all right, I'm going to – yo, put that in the briefcase.
Yep, yep. If he didn't shred them up and put them in the toilet, which he has done with documents. So here's a funny thing as a historian. This stuff is coming from the archivists. They're like, we need these papers. This is, first of all, it's the law. Second of all, this is part of the national historical record. I saw a tweet one time that said, don't mess with the archivists. And I thought that was lovely because history, if you want to do good history, you've got to have the primary sources. Who has the primary sources? It's the archivists who help collect them, catalog them, help you find them. So it's just really interesting as a historian that this is one of the biggest things. His beachside resort got raided because he took documents we need for the archives.
So this is interesting because you tweeted something that went viral, as you are prone to do, because people like what you have to say. And you said at hang on, let me make sure I get this right. At Jamar Tisby. That is his Twitter handle.
You said, if you get mad at me,
and I quote, the tiptoeing, the coddling, the deliberateness, no other racial or ethnic group, much less black people, would be afforded the kind of delicateness authorities and politicians are using with white people who threaten and enact violence against the government. Is this why we think they're not going to arrest him?
Yes. I mean, again, like, you can look at the January 6th insurrection. You can look at the way they made a big stink about President Obama wearing a tan suit. You can look at the way they've treated Donald Trump and his family.
On some side note, that suit was fire, bro.
It was like he wore it.
That suit was fire.
He wore that.
I got to give him props on that suit. That suit was fire.
Can we not have a stylish president? Like,
I don't care as much about that because, you know, of the other stuff that he'd be doing. But that suit was fire. I got to give him that.
Very good. So
he's like, sure, fine, whatever. Back to the archivists. But what you're bringing up is very interesting. So the disproportionate reaction.
Oh my gosh.
That and I think disproportionately across all different sectors and spheres.
The deliberateness, right? How they're being so careful to make sure they've crossed every T and dotted every I and doing it in a way that is above reproach. Whereas if it was somebody from a different racial or ethnic group, it'd just be like, oh, just go.
But isn't that a result of not just him, but his followers and what his followers would do?
Yes.
So isn't it a result of the inherent threat of white violence?
Exactly.
There's nothing, even though we say that black violence is terrifying to the authorities and the powers that be, and this fear of the vengeful black mob coming to take, but in reality, the group that they treat with the most delicacy are white people who are enraged because
they
of something.
Know they're gonna do it. They've already done stuff. Do you remember there was nearly the governor of Wisconsin was nearly kidnapped. Can you imagine if they had actually pulled that off? They kidnapped a governor. They were in progress and it got disrupted. And then the clearest example of the discrepancy between violence that you're talking about is during the Black Lives Matter protests, and it was also during the Trump presidency, I believe, it came to the fore this term, black identity extremists, which was BS based on the actual evidence, right? In reality, if you look at the Department of Homeland Security and they do a domestic terrorist threat assessment every year, always the biggest domestic terror threat is white supremacist extremists.
Yeah.
And that's where the tiptoeing comes with this entire process to try to root out the wrongdoing from this previous administration and arrest and convict. They are being so careful because they know these white extremists will take action. And even beyond the extremists who would resort to violence, there's all of this rhetoric. So after this FBI contact with Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, talk about this rhetoric. This rhetoric, because this is so funny, right?
Bruh. Like, they are literally threatening violence toward FBI officials. That's, like, any other group get away with that.
And then also now we're flipping the phrase that got them in an uproar before, which is defund the police.
Defund the FBI.
And now we defund the FBI? Like what?
Like what? Which it puts us in an interesting place as black people because it's like, are we?
We're not really pro FBI.
Right. Like, are we like rooting for the FBI?
Sorry.
Now?
You know.
And I've seen some
activists. For those who are listening.
Oh, I've seen some activists say, yeah, defund the FBI. Now we've got Republicans.
We actually agree with you.
saying the same thing. We got bipartisan agreement on this, and maybe it'll happen. But that actually comes from a history. So historically, the FBI, particularly in the civil rights movement, had not been all that helpful.
Right.
Certainly during the Black Power movement, we think of the counterintelligence program, otherwise known as COINTELPRO, which was a deliberate spying, endeavor to pit Black leaders against one another, to dig up dirt on Black leaders, to incarcerate them, basically to undermine the Black freedom struggle in that phase.
And Hoover.
Even prior to that. So the FBI, particularly in places like Mississippi, they viewed their role as strictly as observers, which meant they observed injustice constantly. And then what that did was local Black people, they knew they couldn't trust the local law enforcement, the state, the county, the town. So they appealed to the FBI. But the FBI was like, we're just here to observe. So that meant they had no law enforcement body to appeal to. Mm-hmm. So they had to go all the way up to Robert Kennedy and then the president to get any sort of attention. And if they deigned to pay attention, maybe something would happen, but oftentimes it did not. So we have this long history with the FBI, in addition to other law enforcement agencies, of not being for Black people at all. As a matter of fact, being part of the ops, as the kids say.
Oh, no. Not is the ops.
Is that how you use it?
Oh, no.
Is that what it is?
He went from Dane and then to Ops.
I'm agile like that. You got to keep up.
But I think this is actually touching on a deeper issue, which is, again, the further 2016 broke something in our involvement in the political process. It broke something, I think, in our whatever remaining hope we had in the political process. I feel like it broke it for a lot of people. And then now I feel like a lot of us have this very low expectation that anything's going to happen, that there's going to be any sort of accountability.
Yeah. That's the key right there, isn't it? Accountability.
Well, and what do you feel like accountability, let's establish this because I think it's important to actually say, from your perspective, what do you think accountability looks like for someone who is in power, who has done what he's done, who has facilitated what he's facilitated? What would accountability look like for this particular person?
Well, if he broke the law, he's going to have to be convicted. And I don't know whatever the penalties are. Mm-hmm. He would have to face that, which is not me saying, you know, yes, incarceration is the answer. Punishment is the answer at all. What I'm more coming from is
Jamar the abolitionist?
Different conversation. We have to bring Bria in on that one.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
So it's less about being, supportive of our carceral system or the criminal legal system as it operates now. And it's more about the consequences of not holding him accountable. So I go back to even all the way back to the Civil War. Can I do a Family Guy reference?
No, you cannot do a Family Guy reference.
There was a Family Guy reference where they encapsulated in like 7 seconds the absurdity of what happened at the end of the Civil War.
Oh, yeah. No, that's funny, actually. So, fine, you win.
So it was the surrender at Appomattox. Robert E. Lee is sitting there with the Union officials, and they have this document between them that Robert E. Lee's supposed to sign and surrender. And Robert E. Lee's like, so let me get this straight. We sign this, we get to keep all our land, we keep to do whatever we want, and we get to be whatever, you know. Okay, you win. And he signed it. But that's actually in comedic form a lot of what happened in a very serious way. Mm. That yes, militarily the South was defeated, but in nearly every other way, they got to continue as usual.
Like Brian Stevenson said, they won the narrative.
Yeah, yeah. What happened then was a very, very brief period of Reconstruction, but even during Reconstruction, a lot of racial violence and racial terrorism. Then comes the Redemption era and Jim Crow. And what happened was a lot of the Confederate leaders were pardoned. A lot of them got their property back. A lot of them got exploitative labor back in the form of sharecropping. So nothing fundamentally changed in a lot of ways, except the very significant change of the abolition of race-based chattel slavery. A lot of stuff continued as usual. I think the same thing has the potential to happen now. Right. If we don't hold insurrectionists accountable,
yeah.
What do you think 2024 looks like?
Well, and so I do want to back up even before we get to conviction and, you know, quote unquote incarceration, whatever that would look like, because it wouldn't be stereotypical incarceration. That could be, you know, probably minimum security, you know, or something, house arrest, you know, whatever it may be. But I think the minimum is he shouldn't be allowed to run for office.
Oh, easy.
You know, so I think that's just like number one. So baseline. Can we cut that off, please? Yeah, can we make sure that that's done? So that we kind of put that out of our memory and out of our possibility. That would be amazing. And then from there, I think, you know, the conviction but I think it brings up something interesting about accountability, not just for someone like Trump, but for anybody that we run into that harms the marginalized or harms us, that there is a level to which we're not quite confident in any case that proper accountability will be meted out to them. There's a level to which there's a level of inherent skepticism that justice is really going to happen.
And I think that's partially because the law enforcement system was designed to empower and protect white people.
Well, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back on Pass the Mic, and Jamar will have to unpack that statement. Hey, everybody, this is Tyler.
This is Dr. Jamar Tisby.
And we are excited that you're listening to this episode of Pass the Mic. But let me encourage you to support us. You can do so by going to patreon.com/passthemic. And for just $1 an episode.
Just a dollar?
Now, that's the bare minimum. That's four quarters. But if you want to go higher, okay, 5, 10, higher. 15, that's 20, right. 25, whatever it is, that will keep this show going and keep the high quality that hopefully you enjoy. So thank you for listening, but you can take it to the next level.
patreon.com/passthemic. We appreciate you.
This episode is brought to you in part by Thomas Nelson, publisher of Think This, Not That, 12 Mind Shifts to Break Through Limiting Beliefs and Become Who You Are Born to Be. Written and narrated by Dr. Josh Axe. Whether you want to improve your physical or financial health, raise the quality of your relationships, or take your career to new heights, these mind shifts will help transform your life. Think This, Not That is available everywhere audiobooks are sold. Visit thomasnelson.com/audio to learn more.
Bring him in. We're back. Okay, we're back.
And the we has gotten bigger.
Yes, we have gotten bigger. Bria Perry is on the podcast now because she was listening to this conversation and started chiming in.
I said she should have been in from the jump, but I mean, they don't listen.
So did I. See what I'm saying? Anyway, so Bria, you were talking about our use of the word accountability. And so within activist spaces, you're talking about accountability differently than how we're describing it.
Yes.
What do you think? Expand on what you were saying.
Yeah. So we talk about accountability as something that you cannot force on a person. It happens in a community process. And it's something that it's a process that happens willingly by the someone coming to an understanding that their actions were wrong, that they harmed someone or a group of people. And now they want to go through the process of making amends for that. When we typically talk about accountability in the legal sense of the word, what we're really meaning is punishment and consequences. We can say consequences if we don't want to say punishment as this, like, really, it's got a lot of baggage as a term. So we can say consequences. And what we really want, what we are really talking about is, okay, what can the law do to make sure that this person pays for their actions, whether they think they did something wrong or not? Because you can go to court for something that you did, but never admit that you harmed anyone, never admit that your actions were wrong. And you don't ever have to take accountability for that as a person.
Right.
But you can be punished to the extent of the law. You can have consequences under the legal system for what you've done, whether you think you did something wrong or not.
I mean, you can hold someone accountable, but you can't force them to take responsibility for their actions.
Right. But yeah. So yes, but I think that responsibility is inherent in the accountability. Taking responsibility, the person themselves taking responsibility is a part of holding them accountable, which is why we say it's a community process. Like one person or a group of people says, hey, you harmed us or you harmed someone else. They say, okay, I will take responsibility for that. I will own up to that. And then we go through the process of what it looks like to make amends according to what that group needs, the person or the group who was harmed, putting their needs in the center. And this is what we talk about too in like restorative justice and transformative justice practices. Absolutely.
So, but it seems like the accountability presupposes some sort of mutuality. Like it's a
yes, like you are already in community with process, this person. Yes,
which is very interesting as well.
It's very interesting because there's also the conversation between justice and accountability.
Right.
Right. So. As we think about anyone who has caused harm, then what does justice look like? This comes up in cases where of black people being murdered by law enforcement, right?
Right. And also you take, for example, the Ahmaud Arbery situation. Right. And recently, I believe it's a father and the son were convicted and sentenced to life in prison. And then the third person, the neighbor who was involved, sentenced to 35 years in prison. I think they said they have to serve it in a state prison, not a federal prison. And so there's fear of repercussion and consequence and all those types of things. Revenge, you know, I think
that might get vengeance. Murdered in prison.
Yeah, might get murdered or, you know, perhaps worse in prison. And so it feels a lot of people were saying around that people are like justice and people are like, no, it's not justice because justice would have been him.
Right.
Living.
Right.
Right. Like if you steal something from someone, then justice is giving that thing back. If you steal someone's money, then you're giving the money back, maybe with, you know, added something to it. But if you take someone's life, you can't resurrect them unless you're Jesus, of course, unless you're God.
Fix listen, it, Jesus.
Listen, Joy, nah, you know what? There is a scholar activist named Joy James that said, and she said in a webinar, she said that if the state wants to act like a god and take the lives of these black men and black women, then they can act like a god and resurrect the lives of these black men and black boys and black women. And if you can't do that, then you are not God. Mm. And so why are you?
Oh, that's good. Now, hold on. Now. That's
okay.
Good.
Yeah. Okay.
That's good now.
And so there's just.
What you talking about? The church ain't in it. Social justice movement. Come on.
Okay. Clearly, we out here. So, yeah, I think there's just this idea of. Of course, what do we mean by justice? And is it retributive justice? Is it restorative justice? Maybe there's different kinds of justice. And maybe in some spaces, retributive justice is not justice at all. Like you can just take the justice off. It's just retribution.
So I think there's multiple levels to this conversation. It's all very conflicted as we view it from the perspective of black people who historically have not been served very well by law enforcement. Mm-hmm. But I think with Trump and those around him, the question is, will they face any consequences of their actions? Like that's the angst that I feel and that it feels like they can do anything. And then on top of them being able to do anything and get away with it, no other group can.
Well, and I think it is more than Trump for a lot of us. it is Trump, but it's also more than Trump, because I feel like the panic and the frustration and why we, I think it was recently, who was this? I think it was Terrell Owens, the former NFL wide receiver, who I think someone, a white woman in a neighborhood, like she had stopped him because she said he was going however many miles per hour in the neighborhood. And then he's going live because he's like, she called the police on me. Mm. You know, so he's going live. He's like, just a random citizen. And she was getting upset. And he said her husband told her to come inside and leave it alone. Mm-hmm. And he was like, okay, so if you're not going to leave it alone, I'm going to put it on live. And then she was like, he was speeding through the, and a black woman was like, no, he wasn't. She was like, I was in the garage. He wasn't doing that.
Wow.
And we go live because we know they can do anything to us.
Yeah.
We go live because we could end up dead.
They can do anything to us.
Yeah.
So it's almost, yes, it is Trump. It's so much broader and deeper than Trump, which is, are there any consequences for violence to our bodies in this world? Are there any?
And then the question is it possible to even look to the state, to the same state that lays the foundation for this violence to be done to us, to then make amends for that violence?
Or protect us, yeah.
Or protect us, right.
And right before we went to break, you dropped a bomb and you said something to the effect of the state was constructed to
protect and defend white people. So,
and property.
Yes. So then that gets into the whole abolitionist conversation. Oh. And
Bria been wanting to have this conversation on Pass the Mic. Are we really about to? Okay, I think this needs its own space, but we can start down this route, and then we can
at least explore the tension, right? Yes, which is what Bria brought up: is can the very institution that was founded in opposition to you actually protect you?
Right.
And the tension is, in a sense, right now that's all we've got. But then there's also, well, that doesn't have to be all we've got. Can we reimagine something different?
Right. And there's the idea that even if you can't get with the entire idea of just everything goes, abolish everything, we don't need this, at the very least, most people can agree that we depend on the state. We outsource things that should be happening in community,
right,
to the state. And so there's this idea of abolitionist activist Miriam Kaba says that we are doing 1 million. She has this campaign called 1 million experiments. And what the idea is that there's not one solution to all of these problems of violence. It's a million solutions. And you have to really dig deep and figure out what is the root of this particular act of violence. What is the root of this particular issue of harm? Is it harm? Because there's a difference between crime and harm.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and like I was right. I was saying this before, I was on the couch over there while they were talking.
Amen corner.
In the amen corner, you know, and saying that the idea of crime is so elastic. I mean, it just became there's a whole conversation about Roe v. Wade, but for decades, you know, it was not criminal to get an abortion, and now it is in, you know, states.
In some states.
Complicated, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so now the definition of crime has expanded overnight. And so now you have an expansion of the criminal legal system where something that wasn't a crime yesterday is now a crime today. And yeah, so there's just this whole idea of, is the point to eliminate harm and crime? Is the point of the legal system to eliminate harm and crime, or is it to find reasons to expand so that we can then profit off of it? So then we have a reason to fill up these prisons.
But I think there's something very basic we still have to contend with in addition to that, or even prior to that, which is, white power. Mm-hmm. Of course. Of course.
Absolutely.
And even white people fear other white people. This is what kept white moderates in line during the civil rights movement is white extremists would be like, if you don't stay, have this white solidarity and conspire with us to disempower and even enact violence on other people, mm-hmm. you will be the target of that violence and those repercussions too. So what we're seeing now, because it involves a former president, is this playing out at the highest level in ways that affect a national conversation, but it's playing out in a million different ways, a million different problems that we need a million different solutions for every day, which is that there is a deference to and a fear of white people and their responses in a way that is not replicated with any other racial or ethnic group.
But I think, and this also gets down to a theological problem though as well, because I think it is how we construct our view of God, of justice, of righteousness. You know, we're talking with Natasha about the wicked and the righteous and the contrast in Psalm 37. Mm-hmm. I think there's also this, we need a restored theology of justice.
Yeah.
And I think this is, we've kind of started to, we kind of piecemealed it after 2014, but I think we really need to dive deeper into what is a proper theology of justice that would cause us to address issues of accountability and consequence and restoration and retributive justice and transformative justice, because I feel like that gets more down to, I feel like we've run out of the piecemeal, like the piecemeal no longer works for a lot of our Christian justice conversations. Mm-hmm. We need something deeper. You know, and I know, Jamar,
this is the point I was making before.
This is where you live, right? But I think this is like, we need something deeper and we need something better and we need something that is rooted in more than just a couple of scriptures that say God is a God of justice. Mm. Well, what does justice look like? Mm. And what does it mean for our society? And I actually think this is perhaps more important, that the conversation about true theology of justice is more important and more urgent than the conversation about how diverse our churches are.
This is Afro-theo-futurism.
rather than you worrying about the percentage of black people at your white church.
There was so much judgment in that statement.
I'm just saying. But there's a better way. It was because I held my hands up like this, right? This is not Illuminati. Like, I don't know. I was like,
wow.
Rather than you doing that, why don't you construct a theology of justice that gleans from and listens to the voices on the margins that are authority figures, as authority figures and experts, and construct that rather than let's hire a black person to do the work that, number one, they're not equipped to do in that particular setting and they shouldn't be expected to do, but have the hard conversations and do the education work that we're too lazy to do for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I feel like what we're actually missing is that there are a lot of churches and movements, Christian movements in the white evangelical space that hopped on the conversation around justice. And they really use it as a gateway drug to get into multi-ethnic diversity. Mm-hmm. And they smoked justice weed and then got into the hard drugs I'm sorry.
What?
And then they got into the hard drugs of diversity,
metaphor.
Right?
Okay. This is a metaphor. This is
right. And so then you went through it. It just wasn't strong enough for you.
Yeah.
Okay. Because you're like, I passed through
it. It wasn't the high they wanted.
It wasn't the high you wanted.
That's it.
It's a metaphor. It's a metaphor you understand. Okay. It's a metaphor you understand. Just
but we've
say
been
no.
saying this for years is that when churches make diversity the goal, it's diluted. It's weak. But when justice is the aim, you get diversity as a byproduct almost. It you can bring different kinds of people together when you bring them together on a mission rather than the mission being just bringing people together. Because then your program becomes, how can we make everybody happy so that everybody stays together? rather than justice, which always has to take sides. I'm willing to offend some if it is in pursuit of justice. And that's the way we get unity, because it's unity around what? Right. So.
And it's funny because I don't know if you were joking when you said Afrotheofuturism, but you were. of course you were.
We're going to put that in the vernacular, y'all. We're doing.
This is kind of what we're doing.
We are inserting this into the justice conversation. Yes,
it is, though, because I mean, the entire point of Afrofuturism is using the tools of the future to imagine what freedom looks like and what liberation looks like. Yes. And then there's the conversation about, are we focused on diversity for diversity's sake, or are we trying to get free?
Come on.
Exactly.
Listen.
And this is the heart behind what I'm saying, which is, you know, I know everybody thinks I'm shady, but I'm just saying, I want us to be free. Okay. No, I want us to be free. I want us to be free. And I want us to be in spaces that value our freedom, because I think you are afraid that accountability won't happen, or consequence won't happen, or punishment won't happen in spaces where you feel like you cannot be fully yourself and they will not accept your whole self. Mm. And this is the case with our country, our churches, our culture, our society, our neighborhoods. Yeah. We are afraid because of that.
So what you're saying is we need to get high on liberation.
Help us, Father.
Mute. Mute. Anyway, this is what I'm saying. Do y'all see what I'm saying, though? What I say becomes a joke. For 2 weeks, they're going to be texting me, be like, justice weed.
Gateway drug.
You're never going to live it down.
But it's a metaphor you can understand. I don't mean it literally. I'm just
what
saying.
What do you mean we can understand? What are you implying?
What are you trying to say?
Anyway, thank you all for tuning in to Pass the Mic. Bria, thank you for joining us for the second half of this episode. Afro Theofuturism, again, arrest Trump, all the above.
Amen. Boom. Thank you, Saint.